by sort of giving an outline of my talk, I usually find that sort of a little bit complicated. But here, actually, I've got a very simple thing to say, and so I can spoil the plot in advance. And really, it's just to explain this picture. It's to explain the idea that there's some sort of equivalence between the problem of quantum computing, sort of abstractly considered. I'm not talking about implementing or building quantum computers, and certain problems in an apparently very different field, the field of Riemannian geometry. And I want to talk a little bit about what this might potentially mean, the fact that there's this equivalence. One might wonder, I mean, really, the motivation, clearly, at some level, from my point of view, is to try and understand what we can say about quantum computing by using the fact that there's an equivalence to this other class of problems in Riemannian geometry. And so, sort of, the most obvious thing one might hope to be able to do is to say something about problems associated with finding quantum algorithms, or what problems are hard to solve on a quantum computer, or whatnot. This is kind of a very algorithmic point of view. I think there's, in some sense, a rather more fundamental point of view, which is associated with something called the Church-Turing-Deutsch principle, or called by some the Church-Turing-Deutsch principle. And this principle is the idea, really espoused by David Deutsch in the mid-80s, that for any physical process whatsoever, it should be possible to give an efficient simulation on some sort of computing device, and Deutsch proposed the quantum computer as that computing device. And so in some sense, really what is mainly motivating me is the idea, if you accept that this Turing-Deutsch principle is right, you'd like to have to get some sort of grip on the question, you know, how difficult is it to simulate some particular physical process? And if you accept this principle, it says, well, for a general physical process, that there's an equivalent process on a quantum computer, a simulation, which consumes roughly the same amount of resources in terms of time, space, energy, and so on. And so the question, what sort of physical resources do we need to perform some particular physical process, can be reduced to a question about quantum computing. And then I'd like to gain some insight into that question. And this turns out to be a hard thing to do. I'm proposing that this connection to Riemannian geometry may actually provide a way of getting some insight into that question. So I'll do, I think, three things today. I'll describe how the equivalence works. I'll overview what we know about the geometry, and frankly, the answer is not very much at this stage. And I'll speculate a little bit on how some ideas from geometry may be used to gain insight into quantum computing. So once you've got this dictionary equivalence, what that potentially can be used to do. So let me give you a little bit of sort of background. It's perhaps not sufficiently appreciated that finding... So I'm working in the quantum computing model now, actually. I'm going to work in the classical computing model for a bit, then I'll switch to quantum computing. How difficult a problem it is to find fast circuits to solve problems. So it's obviously difficult in sort of a practical sense. Anybody who's been to a quantum computing talk before knows that people will say, well, you know, we can factor large integers and we can search and we can mumble. But yeah, it's not a terribly impressive list of algorithms that people have found for quantum computing devices. That's a fair statement. And it actually turns out that there are some pretty fundamental reasons for why finding small circuits for problems it's not just a difficult problem in practice, it's actually, it may be a difficult problem for more fundamental reasons. So if you go back to Shannon in the 1930s, he proved that we're working in the classical setting. If you want to compute a Boolean function, and you just pick a Boolean function completely at random, it will actually, on n bits, it will require exponentially many AND and OR and NOT gates in order to compute that function. And the reason for this is actually very easy to see. You simply count up how many Boolean functions there are. There's an awful lot, and there's not very many circuits, which are small, and you simply you say, well, how many circuits, you know, would I need, and how large would those circuits need to be before I could possibly compute all Boolean functions? So Shannon proved this 70 years ago. Unfortunately, while he proved that they exist via this sort of counting argument, he wasn't able to construct an explicit example of one. And so here's a statement from Steve Cook in 2003. It says, all attempts to find even superlinear lower bounds, I'll explain what that is, for unrestricted surface for explicitly given Boolean functions have met total failure. The best such lower bound given so far is about 4n. So n is the number of bits input to the Boolean function. Let me sort of explain a little sort of more strikingly why this is amazing. So you think about, pick your favorite difficult problem to solve. The traveling salesman problem, for example, in N cities. You know, how hard is it to solve that problem? Most people would say it's extremely difficult, say, you know, require exponential size circuits or something like that. This is telling you that the best lower bound is not much more than you should at least look at the input. You should at least look at the list of cities. We can prove a little bit more than that, but not a lot. Okay? So obviously the situation is not too good. And the situation, everything I've said, is the same for quantum computers and for implementing unitary operations. The arguments are just a little bit more difficult because you need to use the measure theory instead of counting. But it's all the same thing. And sort of connected, at least morally, to these problems is the fact that the problems which computer scientists care about, separating different types of complexity classes from one another, all the interesting separations are still completely open. You know, people have been thinking about them for 30 years without making really an awful lot of progress at some fundamental level. They've made a lot of progress, but it's all in indirect ways. Okay, so why is it, actually, the most striking expression of this is somebody did an online poll of computer scientists, asked, do you think P is equal to NP, P is not equal to NP? And a reasonable fraction of the respondents said that they suspected that, in fact, it may be independent of the usual axioms of mathematics, which I guess is a statement of their confidence of the difficulty of the problem.
But when does that mean that if you had some contradictory axioms, it's
I guess that's potentially the case. I'm not a logician, so I don't know whether that's the right answer. But yeah, seems like it. So kind of interesting thing to suspect. Why did I suspect that? Well, there's a beautiful result from the early 90s due to Rasparov and Rudich, which shows that there's a... basically what Rasparov and Rudich did was they showed that all of the possible proof techniques, or nearly all of the possible proof techniques that had been proposed up to that point, had absolutely no hope whatsoever of separating P from NP. That they defined what they called natural proof systems, and I'll explain a little vaguely what a natural proof system is in a second. And they showed that any such natural proof system, which included all the approaches up to then, had very little chance of succeeding in proving this kind of separation or anything else. So very roughly, what Rasparov Rudich says is, if good pseudo-random number generators exist, so something that can output pseudo-random numbers, and it's good in a variety of senses, then it's impossible to efficiently distinguish hard-to-compute functions from easy-to-compute functions. Now, computer scientists believe that good pseudo-random number generators exist. There's a long story behind that. It's connected with things like, for example, if you assume that factoring is a hard problem, then you can prove that good pseudo-random number generators exist. Nobody's ever actually proved it for sure, but they have some evidence to suggest it. So people believe that this is probably, that the hypothesis here is probably true, and therefore that it's impossible to efficiently distinguish hard-to-compute functions from easy-to-compute functions. This is obviously a pretty major statement. I should say that I should perhaps qualify. I haven't put quite enough qualifiers here. When I say impossible to efficiently distinguish hard-to-compute functions from easy-to-compute functions, that what I'm saying is to have a general algorithm that for a general input will tell you, oh, that's hard to compute or that's easy to compute, where you've got some suitable criterion for what it means to be hard to compute or easy to compute. And the proof of this, I'll just give you the basic idea, and filling out the details is actually fairly simple, a little bit of work. If you have such a good pseudo-random number generator, it should be at least plausible to you that you can take that pseudo-random number generator and use it to build an algorithm that will generate a pseudo-random function. It's no longer just a number, generates a whole Boolean function, which is pseudo-random. And that function will have two properties. First of all, it will be easy to compute. That's actually what it means to be good, and there are some technicalities in making sure that it's true. And second, well, because it's a good pseudo-random function generator, it's impossible to efficiently distinguish from a truly random function, which is hard to, which, by Shannon's argument, is hard to compute. Look at the counting argument. So this is, I mean, it's almost trivial. And what Rasparov and Rudich did was actually, they really, I think their main achievement was in, they sort of took the argument as far as you possibly can and filled in all the technicalities. But this has, I think, caused a lot of people to be quite negative about the possibility of ever proving anything interesting about complexity classes or identifying difficult to compute functions. Yeah.
Question. How do you define easy to compute or hard to compute?
So what they do in their paper is they just set some artificial barrier. They say a function is easy to compute if it can be computed using circuits of size n to the log n, which is not quite a polynomial, but it doesn't grow that fast. And it's hard to compute if it requires more than that number. So it actually doesn't matter much what barrier you set, the statement remains true within instances.
So what's the distinction between random and pseudo-random?
I guess in the case of the pseudo-random, all you need is a very small random seed to generate much longer strings of apparent, you can then deterministically generate much longer strings of numbers that appear random. I mean, this is the way your computer's random number generator works. They actually don't use, technically they're not good pseudo-random number generators, but that doesn't matter. Okay.
Yep.
Time
for the last slide. So isn't there a super linear, didn't you prove a super linear lower bound for the quantum Fourier transform? Or am I matching the whole thing?
Oh, you're thinking about this depth.
N-squared, so don't you need n-squared states for the quantum Fourier transform?
I don't think I proved it.
From the decomposition properties. I think that's what you're thinking.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nick, I did prove that. No, it doesn't imply a super linear lower bound.
Okay.
No, it implies a linear lower bound.
Linear lower bound.
Which you knew had to be true anyway. Yeah. Okay. So this is sort of one of the reasons, one of many reasons, why people are pretty negative on this whole project. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's saying that there's something very fundamental going wrong here. We don't have any idea how to distinguish, sort of to pick the unitary operations, work in the context of quantum mechanics. We don't have any idea how to distinguish ones which are hard to do from ones which are easy to do. An analogy I like quite a bit, maybe too much, is to sort of the early days of thermodynamics, when you don't know which operations in terms of converting heat into work are possible or not, and you need to discover some sort of fundamental quantity, in that case the entropy, and the laws that it obeys, in order to be able to distinguish which processes are possible and which processes are not. And I think, well, at least a plausible story is that what's lacking here is some sort of key insight that will enable one to identify sort of where the hardness lies in the unitary operations.
So what's the connection between dependence of the axis of the computer?
Oh, it's got nothing to do. I mean, the only connection between this bit and this up here is this says, a lot of things you could try that seem very sensible don't work. and people say, well, how can you come up with a system that obeys Rasparov-Rudich? Actually, several people have got some proposals, but an awful long list of things. Rasparov and Rudich, most of their paper, or a large fraction of their paper, they go through and they say, well, this paper from 1978, we can immediately rule out as an approach. This paper from 1982, we can immediately rule out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just because they all rely on being able to efficiently distinguish how to compute from, et cetera. Yeah, Richard?
There's something the way you've written Rasparov Rudich, it doesn't look like you're restricting it to a particular type of proof, because good pseudo random number generators might exist independent of anything. So and then you're saying that it's impossible to efficiently distinguish hard to compute functions.
Sorry, Richard, I'm not sure what the problem is.
Well, where does natural proofs come in?
I've given a stripped down version of Rathbrock rootership. The actual statement is somewhat stronger, although once you actually write out, my reason for doing this is that it contains the essential idea. Once you understand how to prove this, I think it's straightforward to prove Rathbrock rootership. So indeed, I've taken out some of their generalization. So that's sort of some background to set you up and say, well, you know, it's difficult to, you know, there's a difficult problem here, and in some sense we're lacking insight into to what's going on. So now I want to completely switch gears and make this connection between quantum computing and Riemannian geometry, and the hope is, of course, that this connection will enable you to say something interesting. So here we are, a set of n-qubit unitary operations. Here's the identity. And we're going to imagine that we've got some goal in mind. We want to compute somehow a unitary operation U. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to turn on a time-dependent Hamiltonian, H of T, and it's going to drive us over to U after some suitable period of time. And just a little piece of notation. I write sigma here. I mean a whole tensor product of n Pauli matrices and identity operations. And another important little concept, you can think of the Hamiltonian H of T as generating small displacements near V of T. So those of you who are not so happy with, well, the essential point is that it's sort of a tangent vector to the curve. You can think of it as a tangent vector to the Hamiltonian. And I'm going to define a metric, not quite a Riemannian metric yet, but you think of this really as being a length, it's sort of a length element associated. So you imagine that you're here at this point V, you're applying a Hamiltonian H. What's the corresponding, I'm going to charge a cost associated with applying that Hamiltonian. And one way, well, the metric I'm going to be most concerned with, I'm just going to define it to have this expression. So what we do is first sum is over all 1 and 2 qubit, over all Pauli matrices which act non-trivially only on 1 or 2 qubits. So they look like the identity times x times the identity times the identity. It's a one-body term. And this here is the sum over all the three and more body terms. And so the basic idea is that, well, there's some cost associated with all the one and two-body terms, and then there's some other cost associated with the many-body terms. And we're going to put in a parameter p, which actually is eventually going to, it will disappear. But the basic point is that p is chosen to be very, very, very large. I mean, the intuition here is very simple, that you choose this parameter to be very large, so the length cost associated with moving in sort of a three-body or a four-body or a five-body direction is huge. We'll actually choose this to be exponential in n. The details don't matter too much. And what this is going to do, eventually we're going to be concerned with finding shortest paths. And actually what it will do is it will make sure that the shortest paths never have Hamiltonians which have all that much support in sort of the three or four body direction. If they did, then there'd be a huge length associated with them.
So how does that depend on D?
It doesn't. The only reason I'm putting it in is that, I mean, in general, a metric can depend on D. So the length of that particular curve is just defined to be what you get when you integrate up that cost function. And the distance between the identity and U is just defined to be what you get when you know, infimize over all possible curves connecting the two points. So it's all exactly as you'd expect. I've said lots about, you know, Riemannian geometry. Those of you familiar with Riemannian geometry, it may not be so clear how this is this length element is related. The actual Riemannian metric, the idea is, well, if you remember from, you know, general relativity class, the idea is that you take two tangent vectors at a particular point, so a tangent vector h here, and say some other tangent vector j, and you have to define some sort of a notion of an inner product. And that inner product will then give rise to a length element. And in fact, a suitable inner product giving rise to this length element is I've written down here. So we have two Hamiltonians, H and J, and we look at the trace between H and P of J. I'll explain what P of J is in a second. And similarly over here, we've got the trace of H and Q of J. What P of J does is it just projects down, it projects out all the terms in the Hamiltonian, which act on three and more qubits. And Q of J projects out all the terms. Well, it does the opposite. It's the complementary projector. So this just projects out everything except for the three and more body terms. And you can show that, in fact, this expression is exactly the same as this one up here with a little bit of work when you set H equal to J and then you take the square root to get the length element. Yeah.
Just a question. Supposing you did put in a projection operator. Would that still be a positive depth metric on S?
Yes, it would. Yeah. It would actually be, in fact, it would be the Bayen variant metric. It turns out that that's a very interesting metric, or it's proportional to the Bayen variant metric. While that's a very interesting metric, it turns out that it's no good for understanding quantum computing.
So what is the physical, maybe you said it, but I missed it. Sorry. What's the physical motivation for making a cut at 3 qubits?
Yep. So the background motivation here is what we're saying is we physically, yeah, when we actually do a quantum computation, or theoretically at least, one and two qubit terms are easy to apply, and 17 qubit Hamiltonians are difficult to apply. But what the way we're going to cope with this is we're going to put in this penalty that says, in some sense, this should really be infinite. By making this penalty suitably large, we're saying there's a huge cost associated with applying 17 qubit interaction terms, with allowing too many bodies to interact. It's an artificial thing to do, and it's just driven by this desire to have a metric which is equivalent to the gate complexity. Is that sort of answer the question? So here's the claim. I've been saying equivalence. Actually, it's not quite an equivalence. The claim is that for any unitary at all, the minimal number of gates required to exactly synthesize U satisfies that the distance from the identity to the unitary is less than or equal to that minimal number of gates. And furthermore, there's sort of it's not quite a converse. It's more of a partial converse. We can synthesize U to high accuracy. This was exact up here. To high accuracy, using a number of quantum gates, which is polynomial in that distance. And so you can see that at least qualitatively, these two things are converse to one another. And so it makes sense to instead of worrying about the minimal number of gates required to synthesize something, to instead concentrate on the distances.
Are these gates chosen from a finite set?
You just think of them as one and two qubit, arbitrary one and two qubit gates, if you want. Actually, that's not quite true. But if I use that set, then it'd be a constant, like three or something.
How small? So P, is this true with P is?
Providing P is sufficiently large, it needs to be about 4 to the n, I think, something like that. So you pay a huge cost for applying many qubit terms.
Anything greater than that. So, I mean, it seems to me there's no reason that you have to lump together everything with three or more.
No, there's no reason.
So you could have a different constant, and then those would have to grow.
Yep. With the size of the term. You could do that.
Do you know how fast that grows size of the term? It's probably this.
Actually, that's a very complicated question to give a good answer to. Well, we don't. It's an interesting general question to characterize the families of metrics which give rise to theorems of this form. So you can, there's loads you can say, but actually nobody's given a general characterization.
Okay. So for B, you just use the fact that you can pretty much ignore the higher order terms. Is that fair?
Pretty much ignore the higher order terms.
I mean, you can,
you can assume that they, you can synthesize the parts of the path that don't involve higher order terms, and they're really accurate enough.
Okay, so I'm just going to, in two view graphs, sort of sketch why this is true. I don't want to go into too much detail, and then I'll sort of get to the survey part of the talk. So, excuse me, I want to talk a little bit more just about the motivation for why one would do this in the first place. So when you think in terms of finding circuits or quantum circuits to solve computational problems, people tend to think in terms of optimizing over a discrete space. You know, you've got a discrete space of possible circuits. If you ask a high school student, you know, how to minimize some function over a discrete space, the first thing they'll do is they'll replace the discrete space by a continuous space. You know, they won't minimize a function defined on the integers. They'll replace it by the same function defined on the real line. The reason why is because then they can use calculus. Well, I want to do kind of, that's really one of the main motivations here. Instead of working over this discrete space, I want to work over a smooth space, which means that we can use the calculus. In this case, the calculus of variations. And in particular, if we can move from working on this discrete space of circuits to working on a Riemannian manifold, then by applying the calculus of variations, we get, of course, the geodesic equation. And we know that the minimizing paths must be geodesics. And sort of a partial converse to that is true as well. While it's not true that every geodesic is minimizing, over sufficiently short segments, they're always minimizing, and locally, locally they're minimizing. Furthermore, once you've got this, well, the geodesic equation is a second order ordinary differential equation. So if we're given an initial position and velocity, subsequent motion is completely determined just by the geometry, right? Just determined, in fact, by these coefficients, the Christoffel coefficients. Now, imagine, let's switch to sort of a circuit-based picture. Imagine that I tell you, here you are, you want to solve some computational problem, and I tell you, there is a circuit with only 1,000 gates in it which solves this problem. Here's the first 100 gates. What's the next gate? Well, you've got no idea. If, however, I give you the initial part of the geodesic, and I say, what happens next? Well, the geometry tells you where you should move. Sort of, you freely fall, so to speak. And I think that's what, I mean, that's the power of the calculus. So it was really these observations that motivated me to think about this in the first place, or to try and construct, set up such a Riemannian manifold. Okay, so the proof. This part is totally trivial, the fact that the distance is less than the minimal number of gates. I'm just going to use a particular universal gate set. It doesn't matter which one I use. It changes the constants here a little bit. So if we use gates of this particular form, e to the minus I alpha sigma, where sigma is 1 or 2 cubic a. So let's imagine this is the optimal sort of path, so to speak. Each one of these little guys represents a displacement generated by one of our gates in the optimal circuit. And, of course, we could construct, corresponding to those gates, a corresponding control function for the Hamiltonian, which replicates that path. So if the first gate is e to the minus I alpha sigma, well, you just turn on the Hamiltonian sigma for a time alpha, and there you are. So the distance along this path, according to our earlier definition, is just this sum. And since each one of these was bounded above by 1, that distance is bounded above by m of u. So we have up path, which is no longer than m of u, and therefore the minimal path must be no longer than m of u. So this is totally, it's pretty simple. The difficult part, or the interesting part, is in sort of the other direction. And that's to show, what we want to show now, is that given that this u, we can approximate u using a number of gates, which is polynomial in the distance. And the way that works, there's just three broad simple ideas which let you do it. What we do is we take the Hamiltonian, which generates this path, which remember might contain many 3-body and 4-body and 5-body and whatever terms, and we just project out we get rid, we chop it off artificially. We get rid of everything except for the one and two body terms. And that results in some unitary operation, UP, sort of the projected unitary, being synthesized. And the key is to show that by making the penalty P sufficiently large, we can ensure that UP is very close to U. And the reason why that is because if the penalty is very large, then you're hugely penalized if you have even a tiny bit of free body term. If you have a tiny, tiny little free body term somewhere in the Hamiltonian, if P is sufficiently large, it gives you, it creates very long distances. And yet, almost sort of by definition, we know that the distance is not going to be that long. So it couldn't possibly have large free body terms. That's the general idea of the proof. The second part of the proof is to break this up into little small intervals of size delta, and then we compute the average Hamiltonian over those time intervals, and we're going to simulate evolution according to h bar rather than this. So it's sort of a number of the discrete approximation, and the basic point is that in order to get a good approximation, it turns out you can prove using the Gaussian formula that we need only choose delta to be, well, it doesn't need to be terribly small. This would go badly wrong if delta needed to be really, really tiny. If it needed to be exponentially tiny, you'd be breaking this up into too many different bits. It'd be no good. And then the third thing is to use standard quantum computing techniques to simulate the average Hamiltonian, each one of these discretely, to some reasonably high accuracy. And that's easy to do because the average Hamiltonian is a two-body and they have bounded strain. So a standard technique can be used. Okay, so that's the idea of the proof. I want to move on and talk a little bit about the geometry and what we know about the geometry. In particular, I'll explain the form of the geodesic equation. So the simplest thing to do would be to write down an equation of motion for the Hamiltonian, how it changes with time and how the metric structure affects it. It turns out that actually there's a better way of working, or a slightly simpler form is possible. And what you do is you take the Hamiltonian and you dualize it. You construct a dual operator L, and what it does is the trace of L times any operator K is equal to the inner product between H and K according to the metric, and you can show with a little bit of work that actually L is related to H in this form. It's easy enough to verify that that's true if you do so. So obviously L contains exactly the same information as H. What you can sort of think of as this is doing is it just rescales. You're just rescaling all the three and more qubit terms in the Hamiltonian. So in terms of L, the geodesic equation is very, very simple. This is L dot, DL, the time rate of change of L, is given by some nonsense that doesn't matter, and then the commutator of L with P of L. Let me rewrite that in a slightly nicer form. If you rescale L, give you an operator M, then in fact it has this very, very simple form. And sort of a priori, in some sense, this is almost, if you thought about it in advance, which we didn't, we computed, what you would actually, this is almost what you'd expect. I mean, think about what's the structure that's present in your problem. You only have two pieces of structure. Piece number one is you're working in a Lie group, which is defined by its commutator. The other piece of structure is that you've got a preferred set of gates. And that's actually specified by this projection operator, which projects you down into the 1 and 2 qubit space. And so, in some sense, at least, this is almost sort of the simplest equation one could possibly imagine getting. And yet, what we know is that because this is the geodesic equation, and because we know that the optimal circuits, in some sense, correspond to minimal geodesics, any optimal circuit must, in fact, really, in some sense, correspond to a solution to this equation. So what do we know about this equation? Well, actually, there's quite a lot is known. It turns out that it's of a type, that's been known to mathematical physicists for quite some time. It's an example of a so-called Lax equation. And the important thing about lax equations is that they're completely integrable. There's a factor I neglected to mention. Nice fact here is that, of course, the penalty parameter has completely disappeared from this equation. So you can imagine, writing down a complete solution to this equation, or discovering a complete solution to this equation, and once you've done so, well, sure, to recover the Hamiltonian, you need to put the penalty parameter back in, but that's trivial to do. I mean, you're just doing high school algebra with the penalty parameter back in. All the hard work goes into solving this equation and understanding that equation. And once you've understood that equation, or the solutions to that equation, you've actually, in some sense, you've classified all the possible optimal circuits or optimal ways of generating unitary operations. You've got a complete list, if you can solve it. I should say, actually, you can formally solve this equation. There are formal solutions, but I don't know of a really good analytic solution.
So if the penalty is less than 1, looks like it would still mathematically work.
Yeah, it did.
And does that mean that you get an optimal circuit that uses only 3 or higher? Even, or what does that mean?
No. It's actually a surprisingly difficult to answer that question. You will see, actually, it's not quite independent of the penalty parameter p. If p was equal to 1, then indeed, yes, you've got all sorts of problems. But otherwise, something we've actually considered doing, because you can actually solve everything in the p equals 1 case. It's the only case where you can. You considered just doing perturbation theory around 1 plus epsilon. You get some information that way.
So in that geodesic equation, if that's exact, why does the Q of H drop out?
It's still in there in some sense. M you can think of as containing both a P of H and a Q of H term.
Well, so it's there in the definition of L, but why is it that you only get the commutator with P, I guess?
I could rewrite this if you prefer, so it looked like a commutator of Q of M with P of M, maybe with some constant. Right, but the reason why, so P, M, of course, is basically P of M, or is equal to P of M plus Q of M. But P of M commutes with P of M. So there's just a convenient, I mean, I've just chosen to write it that way. Sometimes it's more convenient to write it in that other way.
Right. Yep. If the penalty is 1, then you're not really discriminating against multiple
gates. That's right.
Then you could compute any unitary by just applying
that's
1 gate.
It turns out that the maximal lengths in that, if p is equal to 1, like 2 pi, something like that. Of course, this is not a physical model. It's saying you can apply an arbitrarily complicated Hamiltonian at a constant cost. So while we can solve, we can say everything about this case, Lee could have said everything about it 150 years ago. It's not quite what we want. Though we... I am quite attracted, actually, to this idea of doing perturbation theory about the people's commentary. Okay, so like I said before, it's completely integrable. Turns out, so this equation actually turns out to be true. It's true also for m of t, of course, because it's just a rescaled version of L, where u of t is the final, it's the final geodesic. So this is kind of amazing. Well, first of all, I should say how you prove that. The way you prove it is you just substitute into the lax equation, and it's satisfied. It's easy to prove. The second thing, I didn't tell you how we derived the geodesic equation. We have at least 2 proofs of it. The Slicker proof is actually to start by proving this, and this turns out actually to be quite easy to prove. Daniel, you might recall, asked earlier in the talk, he said something like, that metric's a bit funny, it doesn't depend on where you are on the manifold. Well, that's the statement that there's a symmetry of the metric. When you have a continuous symmetry, you can apply Noether's theorem to deduce that there's actually conserved quantities. If you do that, the conserved quantities turn out to be, well, it's not L of T, it's actually what you get, it's that L of naught, this quantity, UT, L of T, UT dagger, is a constant of the motion. So that's what you get from the independence of the metric from where you are on the manifold if you apply Noether's theorem. And once you've got this equation, just by taking its derivative, you can actually recover the Lax equation. So that's kind of a slick way of deriving the geodesic equation using Noether's theorem. And
what is U of T?
U of T is the final solution to the geodesic equation. So you've got your, here you are, you've got your Lax equation, you use it to generate a solution M. That gives a corresponding Hamiltonian, and then you use Schrödinger's equation to get U of T. Okay, so it's kind of, it's a complete set of constants of the motion. In fact, you can recover the geodesic equation from it. Okay, so what we've learned is the equivalence. We've learned that the geodesic equation is a Lax equation with a complete set of constants of the motion. So those are the most interesting facts I know at present. I know loads and loads of less interesting facts and some completely uninteresting facts. What can we hope to do? Well, obviously, this completes the first part of a program that it tells you it might make some sense to re-examine the problems of quantum computing from this point of view. In particular, pretty much any problem you can state which is not related to implementations, you could at least hope to be able to look at from this point of view. You're not necessarily going to be able to say anything terribly interesting, but you can at least look at it from this point of view. Something we're spending a lot of time doing, of course, is studying solutions to the geodesic equation. We've found a lot of analytic solutions, and we've just gotten to the point where we can start. Well, it's easy to numerically integrate. There's no difficulty in doing numerical integration whatsoever. The difficult thing to do is that in practice, you actually want a particular desired unitary U as the endpoint of your geodesic. So it's not sort of a simple initial value problem like we're most used to in physics. We've got instead of a two-point boundary value problem, and those are a little bit trickier to deal with numerically. But it turns out you can do it, and we've just started doing that. The bit I'm going to talk about in just a few minutes is using what are called conjugate points. The reason I'm going to talk about that is because it's an example of where using techniques from geometry can start to teach you things that are not obvious. They're not hugely interesting yet, although I think they're somewhat interesting, but they are not obvious from any other point of view. And that's interesting. And of course, we'd like to study quantum algorithms. Okay, so let me give you a little tutorial on what conjugate points are. Actually, how many people have met conjugate points before? Can I get a show of hands? Okay, so a few. They're pretty simple. It's a very nice concept. Cool. Step back. So here we are. We're working on the sphere. And here's a great circle. So south pole and north pole. We've got think of this as the Greenwich line of longitude. And imagine that we perturb our geodesic just a tiny little bit. We move to another line of longitude, and there's what's called a Jacobi field is used to you imagine you're displacing your line of longitude a little bit, and it's controlled by this Jacobi field. So at the equator, the Jacobi field is quite long. It's telling you displace a fair bit relative to down here towards the poles, where obviously you only displace a tiny little bit when you move to a different line of longitude. And this is actually a very general sort of a notion. You can actually, given an arbitrary geodesic, you can use these so-called Jacobi fields to define a displacement of the geodesic, which itself remains a geodesic. And there's a nice equation called the Jacobi equation, which shows you how to do that. So here you are, you've got your Hamiltonian H. It's actually a tangent vector, but think of this as SU2vn. And then here's your displacement, your Jacobi field, telling you where to move to get to the new geodesic. And the Jacobi equation tells you that sort of the acceleration, the second time derivative of this Jacobi field, plus some object, this is a geometric object, it's actually a curvature tensor, acting on J and H should be equal to zero. So the key points to take away from this are, one, it's a second order differential equation for J in terms of a known quantity, which is the just the tangent vector to the geodesic. And so what you do is, if you specify an initial condition for the adaptive field, you can just integrate up. So what you do in practice down here is you specify an initial value for the adaptive field, actually zero, and you specify an initial value for its velocity, so how it's changing, it'll actually be changing sort of in this direction. And then if you integrated up this equation, this is actually, this is what you would see.
You'd see the red line.
Well, what you'd see is you'd get all these little blue things, and they could be used to construct the red line. Yeah. They're sort of telling you how you have to describe it. Okay, so this equation, well, you know, it contains, basically the way to think about it is it contains information about how you should change your geodesic locally in order to preserve the geodesic property. Okay, so what? Well, actually, it turns out that by looking at the solutions to the Jacobi equation, you can deduce an awful lot about geodesics and when they're minimizing. So, you know, I said before the geodesics, you know, they're guaranteed to be minimizing locally, but once you go far up, they will no longer necessarily be minimizing. You can see that in the case of the sphere. If you go too far around, once you get past the North Pole, there's actually a faster way to get to that point. You come back. And actually, there's a reason, there's a deep reason for that, which is associated with Jacobi fields. It's not a coincidence at all. Oh, I should say one other point. A nice fact about the Jacobi equation, it's linear in J. Just taking a word for it if you're not familiar with the curvature tensor. And what that means is that to study the solutions, all possible solutions to it, we can just work with a basis of solutions. We don't actually... we can say things about all possible solutions. We say that two points on the manifold, in this case the north pole and the south pole, meaning south and north, are conjugate if there exists a non-trivial Jacobi field which vanishes at both of those points. And the reason I'm mentioning this stuff about linearity is because actually you can just go away and solve this equation, and we've done it on SU2 to the N for some cases, and you can determine whether or not two points are conjugate to one another because of this linear structure in the space of solutions. So, all right, we can determine when two points are conjugate. Who cares? Well, the deep theorem is that geodesics are never minimizing past conjugate points. So the real reason why, once you go past the North Pole, from this point of view, things are no longer minimizing, is in fact because you've got a non-zero Jacobi field which vanishes at the endpoints. And let me prove this to you. The proof is beautiful. So geodesics are not minimizing past conjugate points. I'm working with the same picture here, but I'm looking down on the sphere from above. So I'm looking down on the North Pole. And here I am, I'm coming in along the Greenwich Mean Line, and I'm looking up really close, so you can sort of imagine that things are flat here. Okay, so everything is flat. So I'm looking down just above the North Pole. Here I am, I'm coming in, and I'm going to go a little bit past, so up to this point here. What I want to prove is that there's some other way of getting there which is faster. It's no longer a minimizing geodesic. How do I do that? Well, I use the Jacobi field, right, to construct a neighboring geodesic. It's this extra line of longitude, which comes in, because it vanishes at the endpoints, both endpoints, it comes in and sort of collides head-on with the North Pole. Okay, and so here I am. I've come along, say, some distance here, and there's a corresponding point over here where I've come the same distance on sort of the same point of latitude, so to speak. So let me sort of show that. So imagine I've got up to this point here, but I could have come in to the same point on the same line of latitude here, and then I could take a shortcut to get there, which is moving from this point sort of directly over there. And if you think about the geometry for a little bit, it's easy to prove, it's in the triangle inequality, that actually coming in this way and then taking this little shortcut is actually faster, right? The reason why is because the distance from here to here, or the total distance, I trust that that's clear, I hope that's clear. I'm getting quite a few nods, which is encouraging. Okay, so this is a beautiful little proof. It doesn't tell you where the minimizing geodesic is. It tells you nothing at all about it. It just tells you that there's another one which is nearby, which is actually a little bit shorter. It's actually the variation is to second order in the perturbation. Amazing. So, and in fact, the right one is so doing and stuff. So this is a deep. It's a nice little deep theorem. Okay, so let's look at an application in the case of quantum computing. I don't want to get people's hopes up too much. This is not a hugely spectacular application. But imagine we chose our initial Hamiltonian. We're going to work it back on the space of unitaries. The initial Hamiltonian should just consist of one and two body terms. Well, the corresponding M is also a sum of one and two body terms. And the time rate of change of M is given by this commutator. And in this particular case, well, M is equal to P of M, because it's just a sum of one and two body terms. So this commutator bracket vanishes. And in fact, it's easy to see that M is a constant of the motion. M doesn't change at all. And therefore, H is a constant of the motion. And it solves the geodesic equation. So e to the minus iht is a geodesic. Okay. Actually, this is kind of this is just as an aside, this is a cute fact. It tells you that if your initial Hamiltonian is just one and two body, then just continually applying that Hamiltonian gives rise to a geodesic. And the fact that geodesics are locally minimizing means that sort of the fastest way to simulate a system is just to apply its own Hamiltonian. This is all very consistent. So, as I said, it applies for short times, that's the minimal curve. However, conjugate points provide us with just a sausage machine, a straightforward calculation tool you can apply to find when this geodesic is no longer minimizing. So in other words, you can apply this theory of conjugate points to prove that there must be some faster way of getting to a unitary operation. And in particular, well, we did this, for example, for a three-body Hamiltonian. It's actually the transverse easing Hamiltonian with a penalty value. I'll use Q here instead of P, sorry about that. And what we're plotting here, this is the time parameter up there, and what's being plotted here, these spikes, you can think of as basically being, it's a measure, as you get lower down here, it's a measure of whether or not there's a vanishing Jacobi field. What we actually do is we compute a basis of solutions to the Jacobi equation. You put that in a matrix, you look for the minimal eigenvalue, you plot the log of the minimum eigenvalue, and you should get spikes down here. And so you can see that in this particular case, well, you can actually see when conjugate points occur. And the first conjugate point, you might not believe me, but please do believe me, it is actually at this point. There are reasons for thinking that. So your first conjugate point is here, and that tells you that after this particular time, at about point 3, your geodesic is no longer minimizing. In other words, after that time, there's a better way of simulating that system than just to apply its own Hamiltonian. We've got no idea what that better way is, because the theory of conjugate points doesn't tell us anything about it. But we know that it must exist. And that seems like sort of an example of the sort of insight one might hope to gain from this geometric point of view, you know, because we have access to these tools that people have developed in Riemannian geometry. It gives us just a new way of examining questions in quantum computation and ways of saying things that are perhaps not obvious from any other point of view. So with that, I will mention just one extra point, which might be of interest. Something that's not very well understood in quantum computing, if you want to generate a particular unitary operation, so one way you can imagine doing it is just sort of directly. Another way you can imagine doing it is to add some extra ancilla qubits, some extra working qubits, and to ask the question, you know, does having those extra working qubits help at all? Does it let you, even though they're ultimately not going to do anything, you'll want them just to act trivially. It seems sometimes that actually having those extra working qubits, which they're involved in steps in the computation, but at the end of the day they don't do anything, whether or not they might help. And so something we're studying is we're trying to find out whether or not having ancilla has an impact on distance measures. And we don't actually have a definitive answer yet, but that's what we're doing. I will come back. quite sure where I'm up to. And just mention very briefly before finishing, you know, I talked about Rasborough-Brundage and the fact that this really provides a pretty bad obstacle to anybody hoping to identify hard-to-compute functions. You know, what can you say about Rasborough-Brundage and this geometric approach to quantum computing? It's a good question. You know, remember what I said, if good pseudorandom number generators exist, then it's impossible to efficiently distinguish easy and hard-to-compute functions. Well, actually, the same statement holds, if good pseudorandom number generators exist, then it's impossible to efficiently distinguish easy and hard-to-compute unitary operations. You can prove that if using the same final line of thought. I've told you how, but you can do it. And so a corollary of this, and what we proved, is that if good pseudorandom number generators exist, then it's impossible to efficiently determine distances on Riemannian manifolds. Because if you could, then you'd be able to efficiently distinguish between easy and hard-to-compute functions. That's kind of a surprising, I think that's quite a surprising conclusion to come to. What does this mean? Can you possibly use this, maybe, this sort of point of view to evade Rasborough-Brundage? I don't know. I have some very lengthy thoughts about that, sort of worked out in discussion with Scott Aronson, and if anybody would like to talk about it, I'd be happy to afterwards, but I won't go into it here. And I think, in fact, I'll just conclude at that point and take questions. Thank you.
In terms of our battery algorithmic design, the one killer is that it's a 2n by 2n unitary. Usually, we implicitly describe it in size polynomial n. Whereas your techniques, is there any way you can do this stuff without dealing with 2n by 2n matrices?
Certainly. In a lot of specific instances, you can. I mean, we have loads of analytic solutions to the geodesic equation where, we don't need computers at all. If we're there to handle them, we can just write down an expression on paper. So at that level, yeah, I mean, you're always, yes, indeed, trying to find ways of avoiding dealing with exponentially large matrices is high on our agenda. But in practice, you know, a lot of the simulations that we're doing or the numerics that we're doing involve, you know, sort of 32 by 32 matrices or whatever.
The last question you asked, what are the kind of the way you might get around the fact that the lower bounds, for example, is that to get the off the exact smoothie, that your lower bounds for exact simulations don't.
So, are you saying, could you prove bounds which held not just for exact simulation, but also for...
I think that's the kind of the last question, because you mean exact simulation.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I want to find it for hard to compute in an exact sense, unitary operation. This is probably an easier question than the approximate one. The approximate one is also interesting for its own reasons, but I think just being able to say something about this would be pretty useful.
Can you, thinking along these lines, gain insight into why nature chooses to counter these things? Because presumably your metric is rather natural.
Oh yeah,
sure.
Sure. Yeah. So actually, something I maybe didn't stress enough, but it's true. The reason actually why we use this particular metric, out of all the possible, there are loads that work that give rise to the same sorts of results, is just that the geodesic equation, at the end of the day, it seems to be simplest for this one. So, you know, it turns into this very simple max equation, which is well studied, and you get all these integrals of the motion and so on. On physical grounds, yeah, it's actually quite a strange object to be, well, it's initially a strange object to be working with, and maybe we shouldn't use it. So it's sort of it's post hoc, yeah, justified based on the elegance of the mathematics. Whether or not there's a better approach, we're not sure. Well, it's a problem. I'll answer the question actually a little bit more length. It's a really good question and something that bothers me quite a bit. Which, if you've got loads of metrics, which all have this property, which one should you be using? And at some level, the right answer to that question is, whichever one lets you say the most about quantum computation. But of course, we suspect, right, that it should be one with nice physical properties. But it's not completely clear what the right criteria are. So if you do any of the sort of the naive things, so you do things like increase the penalty as a function of the weight or things like that, and it doesn't seem to lead to anywhere. So that's the kind of the most obvious sort of thing you do, and we don't get anything that looks like a simplification. But maybe there's something else that we should be doing, or maybe there's some simplification we're missing, or whatever. I wouldn't say it kept me up at night, but pretty close.
So Michael, the reason we cut off at like one or two in the case is because we definitely know that they are easy to implement, right?
In theory, yeah.
Yeah. So then we can also go up to till log n qubit gates, because this constant barrier is maybe not required.
No. I mean, it's the same sort of. In some ways, this is coming. It's the same sort of problem again, which is what's the most natural thing to be working with, and we don't have enough criteria. We don't understand the geometry well enough to be able to say which model we should use. We're not interested here in sort of the starting point, which is the quantum computing model. What we're interested in is the end point. You want to get the simplest possible geometric description, right? If you're going to get any leverage out of it. So in some way, you can ignore questions about, sort of psychologically, from the point of view of figuring out what's the right thing to be doing. You should be evaluating it, I think, fundamentally in terms of what your geometry finally looks like, as opposed to a priori frequency notions. Should you be doing, penalizing three body terms less than four body terms or whatever?
Yeah. So if we start, if we penalize only log n and above, then was it going to change?
It will change. So far as I know, anything you can do will give rise to a more complicated picture than what we've currently got. But that's not to say that there's not some clever way of doing it, which doesn't give rise to a simpler picture. But I don't know of any way. It's a good question. What I showed you today is the simplest thing I know how to do.
Can you say how, with these kicks on unitary, typically how many GOD6 will lead to it?
I can't prove anything. I can tell you that I'd be very surprised if the generic answer wasn't infinity. A simple argument for why that is just to look at the cylinder. So if you roll up a cylinder, right, pick two points on it, well, you know what the minimizing geodesic is. It's just what you would get if you unwrapped the cylinder and drew a straight line. But when you wrap it, so that's sort of got a non-trivial topology, there are many other geodesics which correspond. So the first one is sort of to wrap around twice. It also looks locally like a straight line, but it's kind of coming back on the sheet of paper again. Did that make sense?
Yeah. And for a sphere, there won't be very many.
There won't be very many. Well, actually, there are lots on. There's actually infinitely many even on the sphere. It's just that they all overlap one another. So doing this is a geodesic.
Okay.
Right. So you go around 57 times. Not very clever, but it is a solution to the geodesic equation. So I think the unitary case is a lot more similar to the cylinder than it is to flat space, and so you you know, you generically expect it. In certain cases, we can prove that there are conflicts. But I don't know what generic.
One other question, is the geometry, it might not make sense, but is it hyperbolic geometry
So you're asking about sort of the curvature. Is it positive? Is it negative? Is it, what is it? Unfortunately, I should be able to answer that question off the top of my head. The reason I'm hesitating is actually because I've been thinking about the sectional curvature, which is a slightly different object. Certainly, the scalar curvature, the answer depends on what the value for the parameter Q is, the penalty parameter P, is. And I'm embarrassed to say I actually can't remember whether it's positive or negative in the high P limit, which is the limit that matters. Mark Dowling definitely knows the answer to that question. I think it's negative, but I'm not certain.
Does that mean there's a critical key where the scale curvature matters?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Does the rich key about?
No. Yeah. So it's quite complicated. As I say, I'm sort of thought a little bit about the sectional curvature in the last few days, and unfortunately, it's quite complicated. It's depending on what plane you choose, you get positive values, negative values. It's not trivial.
Shouldn't this approach to the Pullman as well use that in advance for the SAR to do computation in with noisy gates?
Actually,
one starts to talk about noisy gates in the GFR in the computation, so I mean, of course, you don't have the unitary anymore. But could one extend that somehow to search for optimal kind of error correction things?
So the problem with doing this, and there is a big problem with doing it. So let me actually ask a variant of that question, which is, can you study classical computation this way? And the obvious way to do that is to try and construct some sort of Markov semigroup a model of computation which includes classical computation as a variant. But it seems we've thought a little bit about, well, we've thought frequently, but never for very long, about having to do this kind of trick on semigroups. So the kind of situation you're talking about, noisy quantum computation, or on a classical semigroup, or actually on some more abstract objects. And we can't think of anything sensible to do. The basic problem, actually there are many problems. Just one problem which does arise is you know, what do you use as your tangent vectors on the semigroup? Well, you start to think about what the natural tangent vectors are, and some of them, unfortunately, so here the Hamiltonian is a natural tangent vector, and if you reverse the direction of the tangent vector minus the Hamiltonian, is also a legitimate, it's a legitimate Hamiltonian. Unfortunately, you know, in a semigroup, there's only one direction through time and one can move. So going sort of backwards is not allowed. It doesn't correspond to any physical operation, and this makes things quite difficult, as far as I can tell. There are other problems as well.
You said that before that this unique key to be large but finite.
Yeah.
What happens?
So you can certainly work in the Pigou infinity limit. This is there's a whole field called Subramanian geometry.
Yeah.
That sort of deals with the case where you don't just have where you're only working on sort of a subbundle of the full.
Your distances are
still
finite, for example, right?
Sorry?
For example, your distances are still finite.
They're still finite. In fact, and everything goes through it, and it's equivalent. The reason we don't do that is because Subramanian geometry is not as nice as Riemannian geometry. So things like the geodesic equation they translate, but actually it turns out that there are paths which are minimizing, which are not, which don't solve sort of the natural analog of the geodesic equation. Okay. Actually, there's a point I want to make in connection with Lee's question. You asked about the curvature. A key point, an important point, is that the curvature is the same everywhere on the manifold because again, you know, it's of the same variance. And that's, well, that's really important.
One of the things, you talk about communication complexity, I mean, you can imagine metrics due to that, right?
Yeah, so I thought a little bit, but no serious thought about it. More sort of, in fact, at roughly the level it'd be interesting to do something with communication complexity. The other natural thing to do is to say something about a quantum state generation, right? So try putting a metric on states. And so everything I said about unit trees here is also true of states. It's easy to prove by a counting argument or a measure argument that that most states are hard to generate. Nobody can give examples of hard to generate states. Why can't we do this? Well, maybe we should put a metric on them and blah, 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 blah. But actually, haven't had any success. And I've thought a little bit at some more length about the state question, how to put a metric on it. Not a lot of length, but sort of half an hour's thought, an hour's thought. So it's a good question. Both of those are interesting.
Does this have significance for L
applications? Haven't thought about that at all. Maybe. It's an interesting question. It's interesting. Actually, it's strange if I think about it. A lot of motivation for this comes from the control theory of the picture. And actually, they're exactly the kind of people who are interested in things that are sort of analog computers. I should say, actually, I didn't give any references at all. We had a paper in Science earlier this year where we described the basic results, and the main sort of predecessor, really, to this line of thinking is a paper by Kanetcher, Blaise, and Brock. That's a very nice paper in Fisker about 2001. So remiss of me not to mention that.
So this question, because it didn't come about cat space, so it's different from this dimension, it's different from the metric we used to in general data set, which is in real space.
Sure.
But presumably, if you restrict it to metrics, so the prospect of as it's probably or something like that, you could explore a possible connection between.
You're sort of talking about sort of putting some sort of spatial structure in associated with, you know, there's more cost associated with, right. It's an interesting point. That's a nice idea. You could consider two different computational models, one in which you were charged a cost for sort of going from end to end, and the other in which there was no notion of space, and presumably, while the distance measures could be, they'd be different, they'd be related, as opposed to you can simulate one with the other, but you pay a cost. I haven't thought about it. That's an interesting idea. Technically, it's probably a little bit difficult to work with. We're dealing with those sorts of notions, that in a lot of ways it really does help to work in the continuum. You might actually be best to work with some sort of quantum field computer or something like that.
Because the qubits are kind of discrete, at least as far as that spatial.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem. Okay.
What about measurements?
Same problem as in response to Norbert's question. It's great. It's a lovely idea to say try and analyze measurement-based models of quantum information processing or something like that. But I don't know, because it's got the same great problem.
And so, I'm